So here's to all of the good thinkers, and here's to the lonely drinker. But don't you know, let this moment pass.
Hello, folks. My name is Jason Spies, and I'm an award-winning multimedia journalist and then the host of the Crude Life Media Network and podcast. Thank you, folks, for tuning in to The Crude Life, a place for expert interviews, full-length features, and specialty programs. And it is all thanks to our fine sponsors. Folks, The Crude Life sponsors are quality companies who have ethics at the core and have proven to be positive leaders in their community. Please support our fantastic sponsors. In addition to this podcast, I invite you to check out other Crude Life productions, like our weekly newspaper column and magazine features. Visit thecrudelife.com for a full list of our media partners and content offerings. Never miss an episode or article. Subscribe on iTunes or have our free weekly newsletter delivered to your email box. And of course, be loyal to our sponsors. They keep the program free and literally keep our lights on.
My name is Otis, and I am the host of the Kids in Capitalism KidCast. Let me tell you about one of our sponsors. Hatch Realty is in the business of helping people. They just happen to sell real estate. Call Eric Hatch or anyone on the Hatch Realty team with any real estate question. They want to be a resource and connection for you. That's Hatch Realty, 701-212-1572. That's 701-212-1572. Hatch Realty in the business of helping people. They just happen to sell real estate. Hatch Realty, tell them Otis sent you.
So here's to riding shotgun with the Lone Ranger. Here's to making a few friends out of a few strangers. But don't you know, let this moment pass.
Welcome back to the Crude Life Podcast. My name is Jason Spies, and I'll be your host today. In this very special interview, we talk with the North Dakota Agriculture Commissioner, Doug Goring.
And here's to stopping and a picking flowers. And here's to not letting this moment pass you by.
Say, let's start with that public comments question. We'll start with that in the Industrial Commission. Commissioner Doug Goring, describe to me or talk to me a little bit about the current status, about what's going on with the public comments in the world of oil and gas these days.
Well, we have put forth some rule changes, which I know have brought about a lot of consternation, here and there, and people have a lot of concerns about what that means, what's going on. I know one of the areas that brought about a great deal of interest from private landowners, from landowners, farmers, and ranchers, was the part about interested parties who can testify at a hearing on oil and gas development. And I think the part that started to catch people's attention was the fact that people believed we are trying to prevent, or at least it was suggested, that is preventing the public from being at a public hearing and speaking on a plan that may develop oil and gas on private land. The problem is about 95% of those hearings are about oil and gas development on private land with private minerals and a private company with a contract. And the part that has concerned people is, yeah, but what gives the public the right to speak about what's happening on private land? Understandably, if it's happening on public land and the public wants to weigh in about where a well is going to be, what's going to happen here, what's going to happen there, they could certainly have that right. I think the concern really has come from the farmers, the ranchers, and those private landowners as to why does somebody get the right to say what's going to happen in my backyard. If we're going to site a well someplace or this is going to happen, it's happening to them. It's happening on their land, and there's a constitutional right to develop those minerals. People have said, some have said that what you're doing is preventing us from testifying and having standing. And quite frankly, I'm not so sure that the public should have the right to say what's going to happen on private land. And I believe that's where the consternation has come up. Now, with that being said, I do believe that the county or those municipalities that are impacted should probably have the right to talk about their concerns at those hearings when you are citing where a well location is going to be, or where a saltwater injection well, or even tank batteries are going to be, just because of the transportation issue, because roads are being used, infrastructure is impacted, and that would be fine. But we have just too many people that show up at these hearings that it's hell no. We don't want anything to happen out there at all. So that's a concern when that comes forward. And I know even some farmers and ranchers first stood up and said, yeah, we want to know what's happening. We want to have the right to say something until you start talking about on their land. And they're like, whoa, wait a minute. I don't necessarily want someone from the next county or someone across the state or some NGO, some environmental group coming in and saying, what's going on here? Our memory isn't that short yet. We still remember when we were trying to graze in western North Dakota, when we were trying to use even public lands, and we've had a lot of people weigh in on that. But when you start talking about private land, that starts to stir the pot a little bit, and that's catching people's attention. So we'll see how this all kind of plays out.
Personally, I do believe that if you own land, you're quite able to produce as much as you want on there within reason and you know, that sort of thing. Would this type of behavior, we'll call it, lead into where the public might say, you got too many cows? Because I've seen people try to talk about, you know, cows produce methane gas and introduce a global warming argument there. I mean, is that what we're talking about, where the public can dictate what types of activities are going to be done on somebody's land?
Well, actually, that already has happened on public land. We have the public has weighed in on Forest Service land, on BLM land, and has indicated to the government that they either want to see the cows completely removed, or they believe that the resource is being damaged out there, so that cows and livestock should be just removed. So you've seen a lot of pressure put on the sheep industry and the beef industry to remove those livestock from federal lands, and a little bit even from state lands. But for the most part, what has happened is they've had to sit down and work with and negotiate with the grazing associations and others, but they still come forward many times, and especially in some states, with their own type of plan, which means they're reducing numbers or they're completely pulling livestock out of the equation. What's happened, though, is range scientists have come in and said, wait a minute, that's not necessarily the best thing for the ecology and the ecosystem. And it's made them go back and rethink how they're looking at this, because if you don't utilize the resource properly like it once was, then you can actually do more damage and harm. The concern, though, does come from the fact, you know, what happens when the public wants to start weighing in and just by driving by your pasture all of a sudden say that it's overgrazed, or they feel that the crops you're planting aren't beneficial to society. We already have too much wheat. Why are we planting more wheat? We should be planting more pulse crops out there. But that's a decision that a landowner gets to make. That's not a decision that the public gets to make on private land. So these things are being raised because we've already seen it happen on public lands. And it seems that the public wants more and more say about what's happening, you know, in the United States, in our states, on our farms, on our ranches, as to how we're supposed to farm, what we're supposed to farm, and what we can do with that property. If it's not illegal, why do people feel that they have a right to have that type of input? And I think that's what's really scaring the ag community anymore, is we're being told you have to have a social license, which means something that's acceptable, but acceptable to who? And I think that's it's subjective, and it's a concern. And these types of questions that come up when they have our rules are written and people comment on them, and they say, we have the right to say something. You're trying to prevent us from speaking up at a public hearing. No, it's just in some ways, at some times, on some issues, I'm not so sure you have the right, because it's, again, it's private land.
So let's go from one big brother to another, if you would. Let's talk about hemp. What is the current state of hemp in North Dakota?
Well, since 1997, we've had a law in the books that would support the cultivation, the production of industrial hemp in North Dakota. Now, we can't confuse that with marijuana. This is industrial hemp, something that's being grown across the world on 400,000 acres. And the United States is actually the biggest purchaser of industrial hemp, not only for the fiber, but the oil, the seed, the meal. It's used in the cosmetic industry. It's used in paper manufacturing. It's used in furniture, food items. It has a great deal of use, and people may argue, you know, what those health benefits are. You kind of see these fads growing all over. But there are some significant differences in industrial hemp when you look at the seed itself. The THC level is like 0.03%, while marijuana is like 20%. And you have to keep under those levels to even qualify as industrial hemp. But the seed itself it's got some pretty high numbers on protein. Depending on how it's processed, you get anywhere between 37 and 48% protein there. So it's used as a food item. It's used as feed. The fiber itself can be used to make paper, ropes, other products can be used in the textile industry. You're also seeing the oil can be used in the cosmetic industry. It's also used in the food industry to a degree. So there's a lot of uses for it. We used to grow it in the United States. When it was banned for production in the United States, it was done so because it was so similar to marijuana that the DEA, the FBI, just really did not want it out there. They didn't want to have to try and regulate it. It was Congress that in 2014 said, enough's enough. We purchased this from all over the world. If we have states that want to go ahead and do something like this, then allow them to do so. And it certainly has to be done under the auspice of the federal eye to a degree, but certainly states have to have a program in place so that they can monitor it and do research and really figure out agronomically where it fits, how it's going to work the best, and identify varieties. So in North Dakota, we're bringing in 10 different varieties. We're working with the five different producers. We're going to be looking at planting depth, timing, when you plant, how you manage, how you care for. We have to record data and information and do research on its growing stages and when it's harvested, what was the tonnage, the yield. Are we going to be, you know, trying to extract the grain out of it? Are we going to be producing oil? And is there going to be some fiber production? It would seem that the two areas that probably bring about the most interest and probably would have the best marketing ability is going to be the meal and the oil itself. But there is some need for the fiber itself. It's just those are already established markets that producers are going to have to work hard to find. But we're not there yet. We're at the beginning stages, and we'll be doing a lot of analysis and evaluation this year to figure out where that's at. I would suspect it's going to take a couple more years to do this.
Are there any projections in terms of revenue, either state revenue or, you know, if a private investor gets you know, 2-1 back on their return type of a thing? Any financial projections in the hemp world in the state of North Dakota?
Well, we're not really on the backside of this; we're on the front side. So, as an agricultural commodity, it's going to be just the gross production that comes out from it. And right now that's up in the air as to what type of dollars can be earned, because first of all, it's going to come down to what's your yield going to be. And if it's fiber, what's your fiber market? Mm-hmm. If you're going to be pulling off the grain, you know, what kind of market exists there? And I've heard different numbers, so it's going to depend on, you know, what kind of markets you can get established, and you're going to have to find a processor that wants to take it and either crush it and then sell the oil and sell the meal. Those are just going to be some challenges. So we're going to have to wait and see. When I talk about the fact that, you know, revenue, I don't want to say is irrelevant. Unlike the marijuana industry that is taxing marijuana itself for recreation and medical use in other states, we're not talking about taxing hemp. You grow the product to be processed, and it's going to be those value-added products that then go into the food chain or go into the industrial chain and get used, and that's where the tax and more revenue is going to be generated. But I can't put any numbers on that right now.
Jay, I did want to ask you about hemp processing plants. My understanding is there really is not any hemp processing plants in the United States left, that it's all done overseas. And so first question is, has it been discussed ever to have a hemp processing plant in North Dakota, or do you know anything about that? And then if you might transition into the pulse crops, which is Minot has set aside some land for quite possibly the largest pulse processing plant in the United States or even the world, I've even heard.
Yeah. Well, so to address the processing plant for hemp, we do not have any processing facilities in North Dakota. And anything that's going on in the United States right now, because there is quite a bit of hemp being discussed and potentially being grown in several states in the United States, this is going to be small. It's going to be smaller enterprises that are probably going to be taking the product and going through the process of incorporating it into food items, into feed items, selling the pure oil product to the cosmetic industry, or using it in lotions and things like that that they may develop on their own. I think it's going to be small in scale. We don't have any processing planned here, although I have met with a group and suggested to them that maybe they need to be looking at the processing side versus the production side. Let farmers handle the production side, provide them a market, and they'll grow it. I wouldn't say that it's going to be real lucrative, but in a year like this where crop prices are down, commodities just bottomed out, no one's making money on the farm. So I don't know if I'd say that if you're an industrial hemp grower, you're going to make a lot of money per acre. In fact, you just may barely break even, but that might be better than, you know, the alternative of planting wheat and corn and barley and soybeans, just by the way things look. But to that end, maybe that's the nice segue, pulse crops look a little bit better in the commodity market because we have some markets out there globally, so that would help. And I really appreciate what AGGT has done with proposing an expansion that would probably give them, if not the largest processing facility on the North American continent, it may actually be that in the world. Sourcing all those different crops from North Dakota and I suppose southern Manitoba, Saskatchewan. You're looking at peas, lentils, chickpeas as being a viable crop, first of all, for cropping rotations in our farm operations, but also as a protein source for across the world. First of all, you're dealing with a lower glycemic index on the product, higher protein, and high fiber. So it's almost nature's perfect food when you look at how you're going to feed people and keep them alive. And every time we have been traveling this last year into different countries, our pulse crops are bringing a lot of attention. And even in a market where we're uncompetitive, just simply because the value of our dollar, we've been making sales, and my hat's off to the companies. They have quality product that we're bringing to every one of these shows, every one of these trade missions, and integrity. And that means something. We have a safe, high-quality product that the rest of the world is looking for. So even when we're having to deal with a higher dollar value, we're still making sales. We're still doing something, and I think this would be such a nice addition to North Dakota and to the pulse industry. And when you look at North Dakota and the fact that we produce over 50 different commodities commercially, a good percentage of those are pulse crops. And this just supports more of that activity and gives more farmers more choices.
Where are we at with flaring these days? Commissioner Goring sits on the Industrial Commission as well as being the North Dakota Ag Commissioner. So a flaring update, if you would.
Yeah, where we're at right now is about 89%, which is great. We were supposed to be at 80% by April 1st. There's been a lot of things that have been done. A lot of work has been done to get us to that point. And I applaud the companies for stepping up, making connections, making things work. We still have some problems out there. I mean, we have some fields that are isolated, and we haven't been able to capture the gas. But we have two plants coming online this year, and by then we hope to be well over 90% when we look at gas capture. I think, I believe one of the problems we're going to run into, though, is once price comes up on crude oil and it makes it economically viable to start fracking those wells, producing those wells, plus we might have some wells that have been isolated. They might be connected by then, or they were uneconomical to actually run. They're going to be coming online, too, and that may put us back under a lot of pressure. Our numbers may dip a little bit. I don't want to get out ahead of this thing and assume, but you always have to prepare and think about that when you look at this as a big jigsaw puzzle. How do you start connecting some pieces to make sure it ties all together? And the industry's been working hard to do that. And we just got to stay in contact with them and continue to support and encourage those activities so that we can get more facilities going and get more pipe in the ground and get these things connected so that we can stay compliant with the flaring issue.
Anything else that you want to discuss on that issue? You know, you said piece by piece. That got me thinking about the pipelines. And I know there's been some advancements over the last 6 months in some of the pipelines, but is there any issues or any thing of note when it comes to landowners and pipelines and the Industrial Commission?
I know under our pipeline reclamation and restoration efforts, that program here in my department, it's been working well. I would say more and more of the conversations I hear out there is we use your name in vain, Commissioner, and it's amazing you know, how much people respond to that. But things are happening. Companies, I think there's a better understanding of what's going on. There was good faith intentions to step out and do something. Companies, midstream companies, oil companies never wanted to have a bad situation. At least most of them didn't. So with those good faith intentions, it just meant some follow-up. The contractors and subcontractors had a job to do. And it didn't matter to them how things were done as long as they put pipe in the ground. And I think there's been more communication happening now between those contractors and subcontractors with the companies to make sure that they're doing a follow-up, that they're doing maintenance and cleanup, and coming back over to make sure that, you know, the swamping is taken care of, that cleanup looks better, and tie-ins are made, and people's concerns are addressed when you talk about where valves are going in and where connections are made and what's all happening. People are happy overall, though, with the program. Things are happening, and that's good. I believe they're just going to continue to get better. We still need to put a lot of pipe in the ground. I think we're estimating now by 2020 we'll probably have 36,000-plus miles of pipe in the ground in North Dakota, and that's pretty amazing thinking about some states have been at this for 80, 90 years, and, you know, we've really have stepped up our game just in the last several years, and we've made this much progress. I think that's a testament to North Dakota. I think it's a testament to the companies, their efforts, and probably a coordinated approach with asking and engaging everybody in the conversation of how do we tie this together, how do we make this work without impacting the infrastructure anymore.
And that concludes this special podcast I thank you folks for joining us today. My name is Jason Spies. Be happy, be safe, and we'll see you next time.
And here's to the sound of one hand clapping, and here's to not letting this moment pass. And here's to carrying the weight of the world, and here's to screaming, yeah, never being heard. And here's to not letting this moment pass.
Since 1979, MBI Energy Services has committed to responsibly growing with today's oil and gas industry by providing proven experience, strategic locations, and integrated services. MBI Energy Services is well established, and its innovation in safety and excellent customer service is what truly makes MBI Energy Services the oil field service professionals. MBI Energy Services, the cutting edge in oil field safety solutions. Learn more at MBIEnergyServices.com.
My name is Otis, and I am the host of the Kids in Capitalism KidCast. Let me tell you about one of our sponsors. Hatch Realty is in the business of helping people. They just happen to sell real estate. Call Eric Hatch or anyone on the Hatch Realty team with any real estate question. They want to be a resource and connection for you. That's Hatch Realty, 701-212-1572. That's 701-212-1572. Hatch Realty, in the business of helping people. They just happen to sell real estate. Hatch Realty, tell them Otis sent you.